Hello, I'm Preston Schlankofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you and your community. This week's episode is part two with David Stuckenberg. He is a global social entrepreneur, defense strategist, author, and inventor. And if you heard part one, you will know about the other aspects of this man's genius. So we're going to get started with part two right now. And David, welcome back to part two of our discussion. This part one was fabulous, and I'm sure that our listeners and friends out there are anticipating the rest of what you have to say. We were talking about when we left on the last episode, we ended up with what was going on in Australia. And so can you give us any follow-on comments that you had on that, and then we'll resume with our discussion of resilience.
Well, just to put it in perspective, I would like to thankfully report that Australia seems to be experiencing a major wake-up. And it was not long ago that China was able to anchor a port within 750 miles of the continent, and it really provided an extraordinary wake-up for Australians. And not only that, but looking around at the geopolitical and strategic situation, and they are in a period of building right now in their military that is probably unprecedented since World War II. It will not be long until they have one of the most advanced air forces in the world, one that will potentially rival the United States in terms of its modernization and capability, not necessarily size. But Australia is coming around because they get it. They're fragile. They are not resilient, and their civil society is too dependent on things outside, off continent, to survive. And if you increasingly look at a lot of the challenges that they're experiencing in Australia, obviously we came out of a period of news cycle in terms of you could see something every day in the news about Australia's fires or the drought.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
They're in a period where they're trying to figure out how do they sustain life, in regions that are inland from the coast. And so they're needing to do new different designs on innovation, new kinds of technologies to try to figure out how to make water. So that's one of the problems I've been working on for many years, is how to provide water systems to inland environments like that. And we've had some extraordinary breakthroughs. From a geopolitical situation, Australia is coming around. They're going to continue to be a great ally for the United States. And in some ways, I hope that they lead the way in showing us how you begin to reestablish resiliency throughout an industrial Western society. Now, earlier you had asked me about EDI. And so I wanted to revisit that if you'll give me an opportunity.
Can we just interject a quick note? The opinions shared on this program are the guests alone and do not constitute endorsement or official positions of the United States Air Force or the federal government. End note.
And thanks for that, Preston. So as I explained on the first half, the EDTF was driven by the understanding that there needed to be credibility rebuilt in terms of a lot of the challenges that the United States faces from a national security and natural phenomena standpoint. So we did that for 2 years with military backing, I'm going to continue to advocate for that with the vice chairman later in 2020. So hopefully we'll see a third EDTF. It is of enormous value to the United States to hold these conferences and war games, where we bring really folks together from all different kinds of walks of life, from academia, from the interagency and government and military, and of course industry. So, but EDTF also had understanding, I guess you could say, that not only did we need to address the theoretical in the tabletop, but we needed a physical activity going on in the field with respect to looking at the vulnerabilities to networks, equipment, SCADA systems, circuits, and all of the varieties of systems that are associated with those kinds of things. And so we, about a year and a half ago, established the EDI, which is the Electromagnetic Defense Initiative. And you could call EDI, if you will, a field organization from the EDTF, and that it was actually designed to prove or pave the way for how actual hardening of assets could be done, and then to provide that to the rest of the country. And so San Antonio, Texas was selected not only because of the appetite there of the leaders and influencers in the city to have a resilient community, but it is one of the leading military cities in the United States. It is the seventh largest metropolitan area in the United States, and it's the largest federal complex in the United States, with about a dozen military bases and federal lands, whether they're ranges or whatever else. So Lieutenant Colonel Eddie Stamper was selected to lead the EDI, and he's been doing a magnificent job, not only taking the original vision forward and actually exceeding expectations, but he has grown the vision in a way that is truly providing a service to the community in the United States, in that this is an exemplar when it is done for other cities to look at and say, this is how we can make our communities resilient. And so there are still aspects of the EDI program that are kind of being merged into the stream to make it holistic and complete. But I believe that in the end, it will have been one of the most successful field programs in history when it comes to civil defense and civil infrastructure in terms of strengthening things. So my hat's off to the hard work that continues to go on there. I keep an eye on it from afar, trying not to interfere in any way. From time to time, I check in, but they don't need my help. They're doing very well with it, and they're maintaining a high degree of credibility, and now they have buy-in from across federal government, and it is my understanding that there is funding, a fairly substantial funding that will be coming online in short order to enable that program to go well into the future. But at the end of the day, I remember I told Colonel Stamper, I said, sir, just get one pole hardened. If you just get one thing hardened, it'll be a success. But they've taken that up by multiple rungs, and they're going way above and beyond. So we have a lot to thank them for.
Well, they've got a lot of support from the local government and the some of the community there. It's been fantastic to hear their story, and I haven't been able to get caught up on what was going on there since the last InfraGuard conference I think it was November, but I intend to get caught up with that here real soon. But I'm glad that it's continuing and that they're making great progress. Now, you mentioned cities, but there are independent counties out there that don't have that have their own resources, like here in Virginia, we have independent counties that don't necessarily have cities involved. So that would be a model for them as well, correct?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you what begins by, you know, let me tell you this. The ingredients for the most successful model in a county, a municipality, or even a state, really the most critical ingredient is intellectual honesty. And it just comes down to being willing to take an honest survey of where you're at in terms of capabilities, and what those capabilities will provide in a time of crisis. I will never forget that in 2000 and I believe it was 2011, I was actually at a church. I was stationed at Cannon Air Force Base in New Mexico, as part of the special operations out there. And I was to be sharing on resilience, much like this program does every week, at my church. And I wanted to share with the church in particular that, listen, you can be part of a solution rather than the burden that is put on a community in national in a crisis, whether it's local or national. And at the times, we had a lot of wildfires in that part of New Mexico. And at one point, the city I was in, Portales, there was talk that the town might burn down. And it was a fairly good sized city of, around 10,000 people. So, it was interesting, though, because as I took the podium to speak on resilience that day, it was 6 o'clock in the afternoon, mountain time. And my phone vibrated because there was a message from my brother. And he said, Joplin has been hit by a tornado. And I'll never forget that I got another text message just a couple minutes later from my in-laws who lived in Joplin, and they said, we're alive. And that was the text. And we postponed the speaking for a minute till we could figure out what was going on. But the city of Joplin, which was a city of around 120,000, had been hit by the second deadliest F5 tornado in history. And within just hours, I was able to, get a convoy of trucks and volunteers going from New Mexico to Joplin. And I'll never forget, as I was traveling through Oklahoma City, it was around 7 at night. The next day, the police chief called me from the city that had just been hit. And he said, I heard you had water. And so he's calling me, and I've got, a convoy of trucks behind me. And I said, yeah. And I said, we have diapers. And we have, baby wipes and shoes and all of these other things that the community had done. And Walmart had donated pallets of, different kinds of materials. And we were just taking it all there. And I remember that he broke down on the phone. He was crying. And he said, well, just when you get here, let me know. We'll provide you an escort because you're going to have a hard time getting it over here to the city hall, which was where the distribution was. And when we got there, when we exited the highway, what would have normally taken about 4 to 5 minutes to drive took us an hour and a half over down power lines and dead cattle and everything else that was spun out of that storm. But the devastation was incredible. The recovery was incredible, but I'll never forget what happened about 3 days after the storm had hit. We had done a lot of surveying on our own. We had, brought in volunteers from AmeriCorps. We had cadets that were volunteering from the ROTC detachments at the University of Missouri, maybe 200 or 300 people in all that we were dispatching out to cover and canvas the community to check for bodies and survivors and so forth. But by day three, there was a little community next to Joplin of about 2,500 people called Duquesne. And the FEMA regional director came in during an afternoon, and I was the only one standing in the hallway, and he looked at me and he said, is there a town here? And I said, yeah, you're actually in the city hall. Welcome to Duquesne. And he said, oh, well, who's in charge? And I said, well, that'd be the mayor. And I said, let me go get him for you. And so that, oftentimes is what we should expect to encounter during a shock or an emergency, which is that as intense and as deliberate and as intentioned as a federal response may be, communities often need to be resilient and able to continue on their own until help arrives. And one of the things that we've all talked about, and I'm sure that your listeners are not unfamiliar with the concept, is the shoreline idea, right? Where a nation, generally, if there's a crisis in a town like Joplin, they will bring help, right? And everybody kind of comes in from the shoreline, and we bathe that community in the love and the brotherhood of our nation,
right,
and that friendship, mm-hmm. right? But what happens when the whole nation has emerged in crisis itself? And that's what, that's kind of part of the introspection that Australia just finished with. And you can find more information on that on ABC News and some of the other articles out there right now in the media. But that kind of introspection is deserved right now during this time of crisis, as we all kind of begin to come through COVID-19, and probably one of the most, you know, absolute demands on us as citizens is to learn from the lessons that this crisis has taught us about securing our constitutional freedoms. Because if we do not have that document intact, if we do not safeguard it with all that is in us, as citizens, if we do not demand the respect of that document, we have lost way too much.
Oh, you're correct. And that's one of the things that I've included in my guide that's found on the resources page, right at the top of the page of our website at civildefenseradio.com. I talk about how the constitutional issues should be maintained, or they really need to be maintained in order to preserve this nation in crisis. And there's been too many examples of people in power that have abused that power to suspend certain rights and privileges that we as Americans have that should not have taken place. And one of those is our churches. Our churches have been shut down, but other establishments that are less moral, let's say, they are allowed to progress and operate. So there's huge failing in this country already for preserving our rights. And that's something that we as citizens, individual citizens, and collectively need to make sure that we preserve.
Yeah, I can't agree more. It's absolutely imperative. And so that pressure comes from us. Again, our nation's most important office is that of citizen in Rome. You know, you would work 25 years in the military to earn that right to citizenship. It was so important. It carried so much with it. We can't take that for granted. We have to lean on our elected representatives to do the right thing in terms of national crisis, and local crisis as well. And we have to watch how quickly we slide towards often tyranny and control, right? These are things that we know to be unconstitutional and unworthy of a nation that is ruled by law. And I would simply put it like this, and I've used the example a few times and I'll continue to use it, that the rule of just law in the United States is the tether that keeps us anchored, okay? And think of us like, you know, think of politics, if you will, as the dog on a leash, and it's a big one. And if that dog gets off the leash, it could bite anybody, right? Mm-hmm. And every time we have a crisis in this country, the dog jerks itself to the end of the leash and pulls that tether a little bit looser. We saw it happen after 9/11 that you previously mentioned in the Patriot Act. We see it happening even now during the COVID-19, where there appears to be many instances where there are mandates and prescriptions or even restrictions on the public and people that they're not in accordance with the good, sound rule of law. They're not in accordance with what we know to be our constitutional rights. And so, you know, as that stake jerks loose every time, it is up to us to push it back in. Okay. And so that dog can never come off the leash, because if it does, what lies on the other side of that is the hunger and tyranny that has held men captive for ages. And it is such a special document. It requires us to treasure it and to teach ourselves about it, and to teach other children, you know, others about it, our children about it. It you know, I just can't tell you, you know, there was a time in this country where you could say, it's my constitutional right, and everybody would just throw up their hands and be like, that's the ultimate Trump card, you know?
Exactly.
He has the right to do that. Why? Because everybody knew. But is that the case today? And if it's not, it must be.
Well, I think today so many people have been misinformed and led in the wrong direction to think that everything is subjective And that is not the case. Our Constitution has to be looked at in its original context, not in our modern day context, because if it was modern day, it would never have been written the way it was written. And so we have to preserve the historical view of our Constitution as well as our historical view and understanding of the Bible. So they're both inspired, and they both need that original context in order to understand.
The men and women who you know really came around the formation of that document were absolutely some of the most brilliant minds ever to be assembled toward one effort. And these were people who had experienced tyranny and war and the suffering that comes with oppression. And, I've often told the story, but there's a minister that I grew up with. I grew up in rural Oklahoma near Bartlesville. And he founded a ministry called Christian Missions to the Communist World. His name was Richard Wurmbrand. And that organization would later become known as the Voice of the Martyrs. But this man was a leader in the underground church. The underground church was the unauthorized church that did not operate in accordance with state rules in Romania, where he lived. And he was Lutheran. But at the end of the day, he was put in prison. And every day for 14 years, they would ask him for one thing, a confession that basically said that communism and Christianity can walk hand in hand. They wanted Wurmbrand's confession so that he could turn the church over to the state and all that meant and all that went with it and the influence of it. And he refused, and he paid dearly for it. And he is the only man that has ever taken his shirt off in front of the U.S. Congress. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was in 1956. He was purchased for around $10,000. The details are in a book called Tortured for Christ. But he took his shirt off in front of U.S. Congress. He showed the holes where he had been tortured and beaten. And the exhortation that he gave the people of the United States rings as ever true today as it did then. And he said, America is the last bastion of freedom. And if you fall to communism, the world will fall. There's nothing else to hold back the tide. You are the last dike. Okay. And he said, you are a light to the world. Think about that. He said every man, woman, and child in the world has two homelands, his own and America. Everyone wants to be part of this. And you know what? We need to continue to be that light. We need to shine forth. We need to bring the broken, the battered of the world, and we need to let them come and be part of this American experience, I believe, if they'll be willing to assimilate, because you know what? They will make us stronger because they believe in it so much. There was actually a BBC special recently where there was a gentleman from Iran, and he traveled all the way through the jungle from South America. He's now in a detention center for U.S. Customs and Border Patrol down in Texas. But he was a man that moved his faith because he exercised what we believe is an inalienable God-given right. He exercised his right to choose his religion. He decided that he would turn away from Islam and that he wanted to become a Christian. And they told him that they were going to kill him, which is not all that infrequent in those areas of the world.
You're right.
So he fled, and he fled for his life. And, when it comes to situations like that, people who experience that, who have paid the price for their freedom, we need to welcome them in, and we need to embrace them because they make our country stronger. But I'll tell you, it is absolutely imperative that we understand how this document works. That we understand that, it is solid, it is hard, it is fast, is not to be tinkered with. And if you do want to change it, there is a process for that. And it is called a constitutional convention. And it may be that there are things that within the Constitution no longer address the circumstances we face. And if that's the case, don't tinker with it. Have a constitutional convention and have the states ratify the needed changes. But, you know, from the standpoint of legislating away the precepts, we can't let that happen. And so one other thing I'll mention, and then I'm sure you're itching to ask more questions. And if you are, you can cut me off if you need to. But I want to mention that in terms of national security, we're in a unique state. This is not like other periods in history where we're coming into a competition that is well understood. I would say that this is very opaque, that we are in a great power competition, but I would tell you that a lot of people misunderstand this for what it is. And if I can try to relate a quote from Carl von Clausewitz, the best I can remember from my cadet days in ROTC, he said, "The first and the greatest and the most decisive act which the statesman and the general can exercise is to first understand the nature of the war in which he is engaged, not to take it for something that it isn't, nor wish it to be something by its nature it is impossible to be." In short, Clausewitz said, you need to understand things for what they are. And so today we are in, as a nation and our allies, one in the midst of one of the greatest supplanting strategies ever to be designed against democracy. It is a strategy that is simply, I guess, simply put, that the guest becomes the owner. And this is a strategy that predates even Sun Tzu's Art of War. And by the guest becomes the owner, it means that you go into a nation and you invest and you begin to buy those things which you can influence. And so, you know, it would be an interesting exposition if the citizens listening to this program would begin to request more information on the amount of foreign ownership in our critical infrastructure in the United States, whether it's telecommunications or it's the electric power grid and things like that. Because not long ago, there was a study called the preface to strategy that was actually put out by Johns Hopkins University. And it was a tremendous document. And in that document, the United States is compared to a tarantula and China is compared to a wasp. And within the animal kingdom, there is a wasp that stings the tarantula and paralyzes it and then lays eggs inside. And then those eggs hatch from the inside out, right?
And every they said, Texan knows about those.
Right. Well, this is China's strategy, they said. Well, in many ways, you know, and we're beginning to emerge from this, in many ways, the strategy is actually a little bit poorly described in that tarantula knows that has been stung, right? Mm-hmm. And in many cases where China has begun to influence the United States, and begun a supplanting strategy and affecting things from inside out, we're not aware of it. And so maybe a better example would be something called a cordyceps. And so a cordyceps is a parasitic fungus that grows in about 400 varieties around the world. Here's how it works. It kind of floats along on the wind like a seed, right? And then when it comes into contact with the host, whether it's an animal or insect, usually an insect, it'll burrow down into the central nervous system where it'll crack open like a walnut and begin to release a neurotoxin. And once that toxin is built up substantially in the system as a cumulative effect, it will begin to control the behavior of the host. Think about this for a minute. It begins to control the behavior of the host. Eventually, it'll move the host to the perfect point of sunlight, temperature, and humidity, and then it'll kill it with a pressurized harpoon from inside the body. Think about that.
Wow.
This is called a cordyceps. It's fascinating to read about. But these are the kinds of devious ancient strategies that many of our peer competitors and near peer competitors are beginning to use on us. And we need to be, as the old saying goes, as wise as serpents and gentle as doves to recognize these things for what they are. And to begin to safeguard our nation's critical infrastructure from these kinds of challenges that may try to infiltrate, or some might describe them as Trojan strategies, very much the same vein.
Yeah, I'm very aware of a lot of that. Michael Mabee, a friend of our show and author of the Civil Defense book, wrote a paper about Chinese influence of our electrical grid. And there's a lot of other information out there recently is, in fact, of Chinese influence buying hotels and meatpacking plants and all kinds of things that are critical to us. And if they have, through their ownership of corporations and systems and influence in organizations that have a direct input into our safety and security of our critical infrastructure, then it's easier for them to win. We have to be aware of people, and you're right, we got to be as sly as a snake and or serpent and caring as a dove. But you know, we have to wake up to the world as it is, not the world that we wish it to be, which is
exactly,
you know,
the
paraphrasing Clausewitz. Yeah, but you know, we are in a battle for our survival right now. We are. There's foreign money that is influencing corporations, politicians, and us through broadcasting and other things that have misinformed us. And we need to have a class for the whole nation on critical thinking, because that's what it's going to take to understand that we are not in an environment in this world that is friendly to us.
Ultimately, if adversaries can get us to question our own values, our own friendship with each other as neighbors, and even irrespective of what side of the aisle we're on, if they can get us to second guess the Constitution, that gives them the foothold that they need. And I will tell you that many of the things that you said, I could even take that to the superlative. I won't. But it's important that we understand just how dangerous the times are. And I'll leave you kind of with this thought in terms of strategy, right? Many of you are familiar with the movie The Imitation Game, right? This is the movie where Turing figures out how to create a machine that cracks the German Enigma, right? Think about that. It took extraordinary genius to do that. And one of the greatest powers that we have working for us is the United States. Is our intellectual capacity to bring absolute confusion and derision to a malevolent adversary or competitor. And so, but what I'll tell you is that they are equally intelligent, brilliant, patient, and smart. And never should we underestimate the determination with which China desires to win. Never should you underestimate a civilization that has yet to fail. Civilizations have come and gone, and for more than 5,000 years, the Chinese Empire or the Chinese culture has remained intact. There is a true ancient knowledge that they're drawing on, and they're looking at the United States in terms of this is a relatively young experiment, folks. We've got to really, really go out of our way to make sure we stay true to those things we set out to do, and that is to bring life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are things that many of us in the military have signed up for and pledged our life for and to safeguard, right? And the Constitution above all. But China, I believe, in with respect to the imitation game, with respect to Turing, he figured out that, okay, there was a way to mechanize, if you will, how to break the codes on the Enigma machine. But before Turing, there was another gentleman, and he figured out that within each message that the Germans or the Axis powers sent, there was a bit of information that it was generally always the same. And it might have been a unique code that was going to a unit or simply a hello. But that enough was kind of like Pat Sajak, if you will, on the game show where he says R-S-T-L-N-E, you know, and here's my freebies, solve the puzzle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you see this a lot. But within the crypto community, they called this a crib, okay? And that crib allowed them to find those bits of information that were the same throughout all messages for that week. And then you would take the crib, you would put that in the turning machine, and it could literally take the calculation time down from weeks to hours. And I believe that in many respects, that our predictability as a country, the fact that we always tend to present force in the same way, we tend to behave in the same way, we tend to do the same things over and over with respect to military strategy. We are an open society that oftentimes advertises what we're doing in military exercises and so forth in a way that would allow an enemy to create a crib for strategies. In other words, if they could see so many pieces of the puzzle, they could solve for the rest, right? Not unlike Wheel of Fortune. So what we're looking at right now is a need to create resiliency across the United States so that we can break apart any predictability that an adversary might bring and soothe themselves with by saying, this strategy will confound the United States if I do this. If we can have resilience and, grids that survive, communities that thrive, and the ability to sustain ourselves and to avoid interruption, this is going to really confuse a lot of the strategies that we've seen in terms of what we would call systems warfare, where China, for instance, has assessed our ability to present force afield and said, well, if I break these three things back or upwind or up channel, then the force never makes it forward. So this is the value of resiliency. This is the value of paying attention to things like civil defense. It's really all of our jobs to think about these things because we are office holders, whether we want to admit it to ourselves or not, we have an obligation to each other to care about these things and to really demand that we are moving the right initiatives forward. So get involved, stay knowledgeable, listen to programs like this, and ask the hard questions.
And that is the last word. Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based, grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page of our website at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on our Facebook page at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio, where we post information about the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. I wish to thank David again for being on the show today and the last episode as well. I also wish to thank you, our friends and listeners, who are with us on a regular basis. We really appreciate you being with us. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.